I don't think I've ever believed in anything as much as I believe in this. I have zero doubt it's the right thing to do. It's the right thing to do for the consumer. It's the right thing to do for the planet. It's an incredible business model. And it's something beyond just building a business. This is something that I can look into the eyes of my children and say, Dad is working on something meaningful.
Hey, what's going on? I'm Shuang Esther Shan, and welcome to Shopify Masters, your companion for starting and building a business. Within the direct-to-consumer space, we talk a lot about disrupting an industry, but can you still challenge the standards and revolutionize products? Well, Geef Safavi and Mark Rushmore are doing exactly that with their company, Siri. Compelled by the overwhelming reality of how 1 billion toothbrushes end up in landfills each year, Geef and Mark set out to create sustainable electric toothbrushes with plant-based recyclable heads and 40-day battery life. Not to mention, the design is super sleek as well. Today, we're going to cover how the duo started Siri and how they've reached $30 million in sales in just 2 years. Geef, Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Very excited to chat with you both. You had a fateful meet many years ago on this nice boat in Cairns. Took you guys a bit of time to start a company together. How did you even bring up the topic of toothbrushes?
Great question. So it actually started a little bit before then. So I started my career at Procter & Gamble in a variety of sales and strategy roles, ultimately managing Pringles.
Delicious.
when it was sold to Kellogg, so I helped transition the company there. Then I left and set up my own, the UK office of a German advertising agency. And it was during that time that I went to the Cannes Lions, and I was really fortunate to meet Geef.
And Cannes Lions is like the advertising festival for creativity.
The Oscars of marketing.
That's what I meant to say.
That's exactly it. And so we just, you know, by coincidence, met each other at this event, and we found out that we had both worked at P&G. So I was in sales and strategy, Geef in finance and marketing. And it was literally in that first half hour of meeting that Geef said to me, "Hey, Mark, I think, you know, P&G is obviously great," and he'd gone on to work elsewhere. But I think there's a few things that need addressing. Like one, like the incredible sort of waste created by a lot of fast-moving consumer products, you know, whether that's from the plastic packaging or the way the products are made or, you know, their end of life. And secondly, I remember Geef really distinctly telling me, and he's a big Apple fan, about, you know, a lot of retailers don't necessarily think about the customer experience, you know, whether that's, you know, the aesthetic or the unboxing or the customer service. And he just said, you know, I really think there's a big opportunity to address both of these issues in oral care. And so, yeah.
That was 9 years ago?
That was 9 years ago. And then it took us a few extra years and we became friends.
Like 6 years.
I ended up exiting my company. Geef went to work in some other e-commerce companies and learned a lot about this amazing software called Shopify, and said, "Hey, Mark, now why don't we take that idea and use our sort of joint expertise to build it?"
It's kind of hard to imagine that you meet your potential future business partner in that way. It actually took about 7 years for you guys to come together, and coincidentally, it was during COVID. Geef, talk to us about the early days of actually getting together, working during COVID to start a new company.
So I remember I had put together a little deck and Mark came over for dinner and I showed it to him. He's like, "This is great. We should do this." And I was like really eager to have somebody join as a co-founder, and I really wanted him to join, but I didn't believe him. So I was like, "Oh, why don't you think about it? I don't know if I really need it." But I played hard to get. And the next day he's like, "I'm in. Are we doing this together?"
Can I add a little bit of color? Because this is like so Geef. He said, "Oh, you know, I prepared a little deck." This was a 50-page deck with like accompanying documents, which were like 30 pages long, full of like detailed research, like prototypes, it was so comprehensive, and I just was blown away with like the level of detail that I've even gone into.
I mean, thank you. I don't remember that very much, but I do. Well, one of the things, I'd worked at a few startups before that had not been so successful, and like some of the key insights I took away were, you know, product market fit, like whether or not it was really competitive? You know, were you launching in a space that there are already like 200 brands and you would struggle to really do well? Were you differentiated? And so I tried to capture a lot of that research early on, share data. And from there, you know, when we looked at share data, we found that there was a probably just two main brands that dominated most of the share in most developed markets. And the first thing Mark and I did was we ran a lot of surveys. So we started cheap surveys, any survey we could get, not friends and family. The friends and family survey was like, great idea, go and do it, mm-hmm. as it usually is. We used SurveyMonkey, we used Atest, we used a bunch of sites. And then we did in-person interviews with people. And what we found was, people weren't in love with the brands they were using. Half the time they couldn't name it. They're like, I paid $100 for it. What's the name of the brand? I don't know, you know, it does this. And I was like, how many times a day do you use it? Twice. And so immediately we realized that there was a dominance of a few brands in the category, but nobody actually loved them. It was like a loyalty through sort of just like availability of choice. And from there, that's where we got a lot of the insights that we refined and we took into Suri. But in the early days, your question was, how is it working together? It was during COVID. So we were on Zoom 24/7. It was almost like we had a portal in our house because we'd just walk in and out of the room and be like, oh, hey, oh, you're eating lunch now. All right, I'm going to go get a coffee and I'll be right back. And that's not easy, I would say.
It was intense for sure. Something that we did early on was actually like work out how can we find a way to really effectively communicate? Because mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever found this, but sometimes someone will say something a certain way and it just maybe kind of rubs you up the wrong way, or you misunderstood it and you don't say anything at the time, but it kind of builds up this like tension. And so I think we were working so intensely on this all the time, but without seeing each other in person. So we said, what we should do is have this meeting on a Friday and we should just put onto the table anything that sort of
bothered us
that week, which was like this bold move, but it was so enlightening because what we found was, I'd say like, oh, Guy, you know, you said this and you know, really bother me. And Guy would be like, oh, that's not what I meant. Like, oh, I mean, was meaning more
about this. I'll give a better example. Or Mark will be like, what do you think of this document? I'll be like, oh, great, give me 1 minute. And I'd rewrite half of it. And he'd be like, that really bothers me when you rewrite half of what I just wrote. And I was like, oh, I thought you asked for my help. And he's like, not to redo everything.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, well, that was me helping. And then obviously you dig deeper and he's like, then that makes it look like you didn't think my work was good enough or something like that. And what we realize is we're just very different people. And I think, you know, it's a natural and obvious to think that people come from different backgrounds, different ways of working. But we never actually confront those differences with like in an open space with trust. Like we both want to achieve the same thing. We want to grow this company and be successful, but we do it. We work in different ways and we need to respect those ways and tell each other when something isn't gelling the way we want it to.
And so it's a really sort of interesting and enlightening process. But I think there was a point where we were speaking to each other probably more than we even managed to speak to our wives. And
we
so it kind of became really important that we would just like work through things like really quickly. And that's definitely been, I think, a trait that's helped us over the last 2 years.
And it's something we, now we're bigger and with our whole team, we don't have a Friday session, but like it's like an openness and trust. Like if you really trust somebody, you can tell them they've bothered you in some way or something you didn't agree with the choice they made and pull them aside and have that conversation without feeling like you're going to get judged back or create a negative relationship afterwards.
Yeah. It sounds like both of you were having self-guided co-founder therapy sessions every week. Which
kind of, kind of.
Well, the number three reason or something companies break up at an early stage is co-founders fall out. And if that's the data. And the reality is it's intense. There's a lot of decisions and pressure and you need to maximize the way you work together. It just so turns out that we have a totally different skill set that when it works together, at least from what we've seen, it works together really well. And that diversity of thought is what has been our success, I would say, in the early days.
Totally. And like you say, it's sort of, you know, we're far from perfect. Like we're getting stuff wrong all the time. Like almost like every month or year, like we're in such a different place than we've ever been before. And so navigating those changes, like, you know, we get things wrong, we'll still annoy each other or make, you know, like misunderstand each other. But it's kind of accepting that like that's going to happen. But how do you deal with it? Like, how do you communicate? How do you move forwards? How do you like learn more about each other? So I think it's like a constant work in progress. And yeah, it's working well so far.
Yeah. I mean, during COVID, you've gone through basically being on Zoom 24/7. You established these Friday self-guided therapy sessions. And throughout the process, you're also illustrating or communicating these ideas to designers and manufacturers that could actually execute what you want. I believe you spoke to like over 30 factories to actually get someone to agree to try to make Siri. What was that process like?
Yeah, I mean, just, you're right. Our designer was based in California and we met him through the World Wide Web. He was our second employee. He now lives in London with us. But in the beginning, it was really hard because we couldn't travel to see our suppliers because we were locked down in COVID. And so you had to find a way to vet a supplier without getting to see the premise. And at the same time, pitch them a novel idea that was different. You know, our brush is 1/3 the size of most brushes, but yet just as powerful. And we're using new materials that have never been used in a toothbrush before, plant-based materials, cornstarch, castor oil in our bristles. And the immediate reaction was, we don't trust you. We don't think this is a good idea. And this sounds very complex.
And I'm not going to lie, you know, if you've been rejected 20 times and told like, it is impossible to use that material, like you cannot make a brush that strong if it's that slim, then at a certain point, the doubts do kind of creep in. And fortunately, Yves is amongst the most stubborn people I've ever met. And, you know, he was like, it is possible. There is a way. You just need to try harder. And a lot of people are just like not up to the challenge. And, you know, come like the, I don't know, 23rd, 24th rejection, I was a bit like, do we need to like compromise on certain things? And go, absolutely not. Like, we will find a way. And sure enough, you know, when we found that factory who were willing to take that risk and to go on this journey with us.
I mean, the thing about innovation is for a supplier or a factory, innovation isn't efficiency. And suppliers, their goal is to be more efficient. You know, if you can use the same components in more products, that's efficiency, cost savings. When you do things differently, that's complexity. And if you're doing things differently with somebody who's never done it differently before, that's even more complexity, because then they have to invest time and resources to figure it out with you and all the problems that will happen along the way. But luckily, we found a supplier who was hungry like we were, and we're like, this does sound different. This is a way that we can both grow together. And we formed a really good partnership. And so we did a lot of testing. There were a lot of ugly prototypes. I remember the first day when we went to see like early investors, and I had to kind of show them the product and then hide it. And I didn't want them to hold it. I was like, there it is. And like put it back in my bag really quickly.
It's so true. But,
hey, those early prototypes can go into the Siri Museum along with your 50-page deck. So I think that'll be really great.
Yeah.
I think the other question here is when you're going through like 30 no's, also during COVID and during a time where you guys have both let go of really established careers, how do you adjust yourself mentally? Because I think that's also a big ego play as well, where you have to say like, I'm not having a usual paycheck that comes in. I'm taking a big risk. And I'm also going through a lot of rejections at the same time.
So I think it's really important to say at this point, both of us are very, very fortunate for having incredibly supportive wives who work really hard. And we're like, you know what? You guys have to do this. Like, you fully believe in it. And I think that knowing that, you know, they're like working really hard in like corporate jobs, so it enabled us to be like, okay, let's take a year and really give this a go. One. Two, I don't think I've ever believed in anything as much as I believe in this. Like, I have zero doubt it's the right thing to do. It's the right thing to do for the consumer. It's the right thing to do for the planet. It's an incredible business model, and it's something beyond just building a business. This is something that I can look, you know, into the eyes of my children and say, you know, dad is working on something meaningful, which, you know, in some little way contributes to making the world a slightly better place. And so that really helps actually with the rejections. And it's the same when we've spoken to investors, you know, a lot of people, you know.
Oh, they like, said nobody cared about, you know, not, this is a saturated market.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to want this innovation. Like, you know, this product could exist somewhere else.
And raising money is hard.
Oh, but
you only need one potential investor or to in order to go. And so I just believe in every fiber of my being that this is a great business that's going to succeed. And so through the rejections, it was like, well, we're only looking for the one person. We don't need everyone to come on board, if that makes sense.
Totally. And it's a lifestyle adjustment. I mean, as Mark said, we're so fortunate to have such supportive wives. We also have had two young kids in the time. So it wouldn't be possible without their support and allowing us to, you know, obviously in the beginning, you don't earn a salary to work and to pursue our dream and make this happen. You know, there's, at the same time, it's exciting. And so I'd say with the rejection, you know, like the challenge is what excites you, you know, being able to move something forward every day. And like, 1 week feels like 2 months for us, and still does today. Like everything moves so fast that you've got this just constant adrenaline running all the time. And I've, you know, we come to work every day feeling super fulfilled, and like we have an atmosphere where everybody trusts each other, and it's really positive, and it's the best place we've ever worked. And so in that sense, even before we had employees, like we were loving what we were doing. Obviously there's the downsides, like you're small, you don't earn that much money in the beginning. And like, but the rest just totally outweighs the negatives. And that is the drive that I think continues to push you.
Don't get us wrong though. It's not like plain sailing. It's not like, oh, just, you know, sweetness and light. The highs are high, the lows are low. Like, you know what I mean? It isn't easy being rejected constantly. It's not easy when people tell you something's not possible.
Or when issues and problems happen, which they do, and they still happen today.
Yeah, of course. But like for us, it's about, you know, we have a belief in the mission. We have a belief in the product. We have a belief in our team. We have a belief in each other. And that sort of is like this guiding light through everything.
I feel like when you're in a startup, like the days feel like jam-packed. So you're on this like expedited, but yet like super full day. So,
totally.
Yeah. How many iterations for the toothbrush did it get to the point where you were actually 100% happy with it?
Oh, like quite a few. So we launched in May. We did pre-sales on Shopify. We did quite a few iterations, probably like 20 iterations before we launched. We did testing with dentists and sustainability experts early on. We did like a 500 batch, then a 1,000 batch. And then as we've launched, we're constantly iterating the inside of the brush because one of the things for us is like if anything happens, we recover the brush. We want to be able to take it apart, investigate it, you know, repair it if we can, or recycle the components. And that requires us to constantly like improve the way our structure works. So we're constantly changing the product. But I guess the main thing for us was that we needed to achieve minimal lovable product. And through our testing, we launched finally when we were like, people actually do enjoy this. Because I think gone are the days of a minimal viable product. There's so much competition out there. Anybody can get a supplier to make them an average product, rebrand it, do really nice graphics, and then not really cut through. And so if you really want to cut through in the market, you have to have something that people really enjoy and get behind. And I guess you could say when we launched, we didn't realize that people really loved the product. We thought we were there. We're like, this is good enough. This is better than average. But like we started to see the reviews come in, and then I think for the first year, we never even talked about enjoying our brush. But like what we started hearing people say is like, I never enjoyed brushing my teeth. Now I do. This is awkward.
They love brushing their teeth. So we have a 4.8 rating on Trustpilot with, I think, almost 7,000 reviews now. And that's been like a bedrock of you know, our growth is, you know, people loving it and then sharing it with others. But I think to the point about the iterations, like, we really, really care about the little details, you know, like crazy little details. Both Keith and I have a passion for, you know, even like, oh, the font size on the inside of the packaging or this little phrase. We scrutinize these tiny details. Dylan as well, you know, like this angle. Oh, no, they've got this angle like slightly out. And
oh my God,
it's almost like too much invisible sometimes to the naked eye. But it's like it's the culmination of all those little tiny decisions across packaging, across your checkout, across the whole user experience, which like add up, I think, to people having a really great experience because they can see and appreciate the detail and thought that's gone into a lot of small decisions.
And as I said, it's come from customers telling us where their pain points were, because we knew it's fine. There's quite a few established brands. What are we going to do that's different? Like, we want to listen to people and hear what are they saying that they're not enjoying, or what are they not saying that we could actually create. So one of the features we have on our brush is a mirror mount. And, you know, people often, when you charge your brush every day, you get this buildup of gunk. I don't know what you call it, toothpaste gunk. And it's like a yellow ring.
I know that very well. Yes.
Right. It's pretty gross.
Yeah.
You also get it under the head too. And so we're like, how do we eliminate that? Well, one, we focused on a longer battery life. So our brush lasts 40 days. And we created a mirror mount that you could hang it on. And as a result, like, instead of having to be on charge and build up gunk, it just drips off on the counter and it wipes off because it's not constantly being built up. And then under our brush head, we have a stainless steel plate. So when gunk does build up there, it wipes off pretty quickly, as opposed to being ingrained in like a plastic cover.
I, as someone who's unpacked and experienced it, I truly appreciate the finer details. I mean, obviously you will say that there are things that you've gotten wrong, but from our perspective, or from my perspective through this conversation, it seems like there were so many things you were thinking about pre-launch: the dynamic between the two of you, the relationship, the product itself, and then also the communication, the pre-orders. If you were to give advice for the whole pre-launch experience for founders, what are some key takeaways you think everybody should think about?
Great question.
That's a really good question.
I think something, and I have to totally credit Yves with this, is Yves had the foresight to have our customer service software set up prior to launch. So we used Gorgeous for that. And we had this thing where we had, I think, 5,000 pre-orders. And so our 3PL went from having never shipped a single product to having to ship 5,000 orders in like 2-3 days. And unfortunately, there was a mistake with a portion of the orders where it meant 1,000 of the 5,000 customers were going to have a week delay on their product. So we went from having no customer service tickets to having to tell 1,000 people this product they were going to be been waiting for was going to be a week late.
I think it was more than a week. It was like three or 4 weeks. Yeah, we went from having
maybe it was a little bit later.
To a bunch of angry emails we need to quickly respond to.
But it was actually because Yves had sort of had the foresight and the experience from prior places to know, okay, let's have this system set up so that we can proactively communicate, so that we can, you know, address any potential issues. And at the time, like, I swear we were like, not quite in tears, but like, this is going to sink the company. Like, we've only just started. This is huge. Like, oh my goodness, how are we going to deal with it? Now looking back, we can laugh. But like, I remember, like, really at the time,
we'd
like,
get
it was
a
like
lot of refund requests because we were already 2 months late. But we didn't. We got people saying, "Oh, that's so great! Thanks for informing us. Like, we, you know, really excited to get it."
And so I think my tip would be to really communicate. You know, it's amazing. Like, your early adopters and those customers, like, are actually really understanding. We didn't have a single refund as a result of that, I think.
Communications.
And so I think a combination of, you know, thinking about your infrastructure to help you, you know, address customers, but also like being proactive in your communication.
I'm really risk averse and detailed, as Mark said. So one of the things I think would probably be my tip would be, you know, as we started doing our research, getting all those insights is really important. And just feeling, and before we launched, you know, we pre-launched on Shopify, but we had multiple landing pages that we were testing. We were doing, in the beginning, fake ads to emails to just see, like, to refine the concept further. What was the communication message that was actually working and driving the conversion to an email? And it's a proxy to a sale. And then as we started sort of doing pre-sales, we were able to see what is the communication message that really worked to drive the sale. But that helped us refine, even though the product was getting pretty close to final, it helped us refine a lot of the ways we communicated. So one of the hypotheses we had was that people didn't care about sustainability. You know, it's a toothbrush that's more sustainable. Great. People just want a toothbrush, which was something that a few friends and family, say investors, have told us. But it wasn't true. It was just like the order in which you communicated it and where you communicated it. And also, like, we don't talk about design. We talk about the features, right? We don't say, like, a great design toothbrush that you're going to love the design and it's going to feel really premium in your hand. Instead, we show that through really beautiful visuals and renders. And so testing a lot before you even sell is a great way. Even if you don't have a product ready, you can do renders really well. So we were fortunate that our product designer obviously could do beautiful renders and make it look lifelike. And so you was like, that's a real product that I want. You could test different design shapes and just get see people, you know, which one would sign up on email. And that's a really close, not immediate, but it's close to sales. And so the more, we did a lot of testing early on to find out what is the right communication messaging so that when we launch, this is how we're going to drive, you know, click through and ads sales. Yeah. And we still do that today. We're still constantly refining everything, really looking into the details. How long do people look at our ads for the first 3 seconds? You know, the middle part, the end, and then which landing page converted better.
That's really nerdy and I love it so much because I think sometimes founders like feel like they need to have everything ready before they can test advertising or even speak to the market. But to your point, when you're iterating and testing before you launch, it helps inform how you're going to market in the future. So
it's, completely, yeah.
I think also that process, as Keith sort of said, like doesn't ever stop. So yeah. Like what we were sort of doing then.
We still do it now.
To an extent, we're still just doing better. It now. Like, we're just constantly trying to iterate and improve and learn on everything.
If you see our ads, I mean, it's like 20 bits of content stuck together. And the reason is that it's different for a lot of, we changed little parts in it just to improve the conversion rate. And the story. The story is the most important part, but it's like, how do we make that story even clearer? Because like you want to communicate all the features, but you can't. You know, you've got a 10-second dwell time on your ad, a Facebook ad, for example. So how do you get somebody excited to click through and want to buy it just on that? So it's a pretty tough challenge.
Yeah. It's especially tough because to your point, like this is a category where it was kind of boring before. I got a toothbrush because my dentist gave me the toothbrush recommendation. So I think the way that you've honed in and really refined the way that you communicate Siri is really special.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And then the both of you coming from really established, accomplished careers from the corporate world, and then you enter into entrepreneurship. I love highlighting stories like this because I think like nothing is an overnight success and you had decades of experience leading up to this moment. I guess, where were some of those like random learnings from the corporate world that in the moment you probably were thinking it's tedious or laborious, but then today it actually helps you?
I'm just going to take this one. So when it comes to anything commercial, Mark is a complete strategy expert there. And I feel like from the beginning, I had no doubt if we ever could do well in retail, just because it's like his time at P&G really built a bedrock of information there that, I mean, from the beginning, like pricing, all of that, like pretty much I was like, that's your call. You know so much on that I would say that's like.
Hey, thank you. Yeah, and the truth is, like, I draw on it every single day, like, and it's very much like, you know, shout out Procter & Gamble, like, incredible training, and also like I love it, like it's really enjoyable, like learning about retail, about merchandising principles, about pricing, promotions, about relationships, negotiation, selling. I think you just learn so many core skills and get given a lot of responsibility. I would say the decision to work there was actually very intentional because it was a great sort of like almost business school for learning how to run a brand and how to sell a brand into a retailer, how to market and finance a brand.
It's quite a big organization, obviously, but you get quite a lot of responsibility early on.
Yeah. And now both of you are literally competing in the same category as the giant. So it's really cool.
Totally.
But it's a very big category. Believe it or not, most people brush their teeth. So yeah.
There's room space for everybody. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Amazing. And then we touched on this a little bit as well during COVID, the whole journey. How do you balance your own personal lives, your personal growth as you're growing a company in the early days and looking after yourself?
Genuinely, you know, two children, my wife and Suri, like there's only so many hours in the day. And the truth is like, I probably see my friends a lot less.
I was about to say I have no personal life.
Yeah. like personal life is sort of like work and family. And yeah, it's, there isn't really as much time for other things, which can be hard. But I think you say in the early days, but like even now, like I would say we're busier than ever with so much demands on our time and, you know, international travel. And so it's definitely like a learn as you go along and try and, you know, improve. Like definitely something I found is doing more exercise actually like really helps with mental clarity and also stress. I find like, you know, going for a walk, going for a run, going for a swim or something like that is like a big benefit. But truth be told, like that, I think working this hard comes with sacrifice, and I'd love to say it didn't, but I think I
agree. I think it's a conscious choice. Like if we weren't enjoying it, we wouldn't be doing it. Otherwise we'd be fooling ourselves. And I think by, you know, I don't have very much time to see friends, but I think that's natural as you become a parent of two young kids. You probably don't also. Prioritizing the moment has become important to me. So like I used to be the kind of person that could like, oh, I don't know, watch TV, be on my laptop at the same time. And now I can't, right? So what I try to do is when I come home, I mean, for those 2 hours that I'm home until my kids go to bed, like there's no phone time, I'm playing with them. And when I come to work, that's what I'm doing. And by accepting that the moments that I am going to have time on, I'm really going to be focused in them, I will enjoy them more. And on the weekend, we are often working, but not sitting there typing. It's more like, obviously there's toddlers running around me, but I'm thinking like, what else could be exciting, you know, and what else could we do?
I've actually got a good top tip for any entrepreneurs with kids, which is like you say, put your phone down when you get there. It's very easy in practice, but sometimes like, you know, oh my goodness, I want to just check my emails or something. I went and bought a phone jail from Amazon. I don't know if I told you that.
Is that a thing with a key?
It's not a key. It's got like a timer, and you put like an hour, and then you cannot access it like until the hour's up. And it's kind of, I don't know, it just kind of like frees my mind.
I definitely need a phone jail because you're right. Like, well, my daughter wants to watch movies on it. Right? And she's like, and I'm just like, no, it's phone time for anybody.
But now my kids are like, Dad, phone jail. Like, okay. And then it's so nice because you can just, you know, go and have a little play in the garden with them or read a book.
I mean, we still see friends. We're not that like.
No, yeah.
But I mean, I think when you're juggling things, you have to decide which one's going to drop. And if you try to make time for everything, you might not make it work. And so I think I'd say our social lives dropped a bit, but happiness and fulfillment everywhere else.
Yeah.
But I think we need to ask the question that I wanted to ask for a long time is, I feel like the two of you kind of clicked and knew that you wanted to be co-founders. I guess, what's your advice for people who are thinking about finding a co-founder, finding someone to start a business together? Like, what should they think about?
It's really good. So I previously ran a company by myself, and so did Mark. It's a bit lonely at the top. So like I knew from the outset that I wanted somebody that was on the business with me. And I think Mark also, because, you know, there's so much that you need to discuss and think about. And your family doesn't want to hear that much after a while, and or a partner or a significant other. And the good news is your co-founder will. They'll be like, yeah, constantly thinking about it. So I think that's important. Some people can do it by themselves. I think that's a choice that you'll know better, but there's quite a lot of tough decisions and moments where, I mean, I know my previous company, I was, you know, pretty low moments. And interestingly is like a low moment for me will not necessarily be a low moment for Mark, and he'll pick me up and vice versa. I'll be like, oh, you look really down today. Like pick it up. Like, let's go out. Let's grab some coffee. And so that really helps, I think, because in the beginning it can be quite tough.
I think as well, like we're really lucky, and it's not a total coincidence that we have quite complementary skill sets and you know, background, even finance and marketing, me in more sales and strategy. And so we have our own sort of areas of expertise and domain. We also have very different personalities, which, you know, as we said, you know, can be challenging at times, but also it really helps because it gives us like a broader perspective. The key there, and I think the key for anyone who's looking for a co-founder, is to find someone who you can have really good communication with. You know, and that good communication doesn't mean like you have to agree on everything. You have to, you know, always like get on perfectly, but it means that, you know, when you do encounter problems, that you can talk about it and the kind of like, you know, and work through it and come out with like a better solution. I think we always talk about, you know, 1 + 1 = 3. Do you know what I mean? It's like we're greater than the sum of our parts. And I think it's really special when you can find someone like that.
The only thing I would say I find really hard are the people who are in a relationship together. And that, I have, hats off, I don't know if I could ever do that, you know?
We've had many episodes with founders who are life and business partners.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm fascinated by that dynamic.
My parents actually set up a business together. And yeah, like for me growing up, it was like my other sibling almost, like hearing them talk about it and the way they talk about it.
Yeah. Because it's at the dinner table and breakfast table.
But it was 24/7.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, yeah, I mean.
I mean, to be fair, like our wives hear it all too.
Yeah.
But there's a moment when they're like, please stop.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay. Phone jail time. We'll do that.
Nice. Well, I'm so glad that you guys have found this synergy and very excited to get into the scaling of Siri.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Guive Safavi and Mark Rushmore, the co-founders of Siri. Our show is produced by Gogo Zoger and Megan Coyle. Engineers are Matt Schwartz and Miku Betlem. Benjamin Gottlieb is our managing producer, and I'm your host, Shuang Esther Shan. This episode was recorded at Cube East. Come back every Tuesday and Thursday to catch a brand new episode of Shopify Masters. If you're still here, go share this episode with another founder. Thank you so much.